All right, so today I'm going to talk about not really anything watershed specific, but what you can do after you have a watershed model, specifically how to use climate change projections, how to downscale climate change projections so that you can do future analyses with your calibrated watershed model. So as we all are aware, climate change is expected to have a significant impact on precipitation and temperature throughout the globe. And when you say that throughout the globe and you look, zoom in on what's actually happened in the U.S., you can see air temperature and precipitation are quite varied in between regions. You have increases in temperature basically throughout the western U.S., but if you look at the southern U.S., there's some decreases in particular areas. And precipitation in the same vein is just all over the place. And these are just recent changes. So to say that things are happening on the global scale doesn't really mean a whole lot on the local scale, especially on hydrology. So for watershed modeling or bathymetric zone modeling or crop modeling, to assess how future climate change may affect local and regional hydrologic regimes, there's basically two ways of doing this. You can perform a sensitivity assessment, so develop sensitivity scenarios where you increase temperature plus 2, plus 4, plus 6, and you change how precipitation is changing compared to present day averages. And these are cool. These work. These bracket the ranges quite well if you're talking about climate change scenarios, but air and temperature and precipitation are often coupled with each other, and they don't often work in a step fashion. So while these do give you information, they don't give you very good information. In order to have some robust climate change projections, you need to use GCMs, general circulation models, and I may use the word global climate models as well. I kind of interchange them, but GCMs. But the problem with that is that these are much too coarse for watershed scale assessment. We're talking hundreds of kilometers. So in order to do that, you need to downscale that. And there are options available throughout the internet. There's databases available of this stuff. So the modeling chain looks something similar to this. And on the right, you have greenhouse gas emissions. So what do you expect CO2? What do you expect fossil fuels? How dependent we are going to be on fossil fuels in the future? Are we going to be less dependent, more dependent, et cetera? So you throw those into a general circulation model, and these, which accurately simulate the global climate, global temperature and air temperature, global temperature and precipitation, and you kind of determine how sensitive the climate system is to these greenhouse gas emission scenarios. Now you can see, hopefully, that the grid of the GCM, that's basically what they look like. The grid of the GCM is the really large scale, so we're talking hundreds of kilometers. So you can't do a whole lot of work at the watershed scale. So in order to do your work at the watershed scale, you need to do number three, which is basically somehow translate large-scale climate signals down to the watershed scale. And then you can input this into a watershed model, and then you can either stop there or keep going, depending on what your study is. So why can't you use GCMs? Why can't you use the output from climate models? Now, these are available to download anywhere. Just GCM output. But why can't you use them? Well, they have biases, largely due to the spatial resolution. So these GCMs are built to simulate the global climate, not necessarily to simulate the climate at your particular location. And they do have biases associated with them. So if you look at the figure on the right, this is precipitation rate for the winter in the California region. And you can see that the GCM historical basically has a wet bias. So it's wetter. It's wetter than is your observed data. This is largely due to the parameterization and the spatial resolution to where the GCMs are meant to predict large-scale climates, not necessarily what's going on at a single node. This output data is roughly 100 to 250 kilometers, so you can't really do a whole lot with it, especially if there's bias associated with these simulations and projections. Now, you can run regional climate models, RCMs. You can run those. Those are at a higher resolution, roughly around 10-kilometer scale or around there, depending on the RCM. But they are extremely computationally expensive, as in you can't run this on your desktop or laptop or anything like that. And what these do, they're smaller scale models. They use the GCM as a boundary condition to your RCM. So there is bias associated with them, so we need to fix those. So you bring up the topic of downscaling, and all the downscaling is bringing global signals or regional scale, large-scale regional signals down to something at the watershed or localized scale. Again, GCMs are much too coarse of a scale to actually do some analysis with it. And if you look at a GCM output in the top left, and then actually what a downscaled output or observed output would look like on the right, And if you look below that, that's how GCMs simulate, and that's how they represent the localized land surface. So you can see there's a snow, there's a grass surface, there's the ocean. Okay, so it's simulating these in a step fashion, when in reality, if you look over to the right, the actual landscape looks something similar to that, where you have snow, and you have the tree line, and then you have down into a river valley, down into perhaps another river valley, down into the ocean. So the GCMs are missing the stuff that happens in between. So that's why there's bias associated with that. And you can resolve this by bias correction and also spatial downscaling. And we'll talk about both of these. So again, some of the GCM resolutions out there, there's a lot of GCMs. I'm showing 20 of them right now, but each basically NASA has a few. There's a couple, they have three right there. NOAA has a couple. But there are a lot of GCMs out there where they simulate the climate. Now, they all work well at simulating the global climate. And they're all at different resolutions. The ones I show here are roughly anywhere between 45 kilometers all the way up until 250 kilometers. So they vary in scale. And again, they're all too large of scale to work with. And then you look at the precipitation and temperature being collected, the observed precipitation and temperature, and we're pretty well covered throughout the U.S. Now you do see a lot of gray splotches throughout the U.S. This basically represents areas where we don't have any measurements going on. And we do have some important areas that we're not measuring very well, especially if you look out west, the desert regions, the high elevation regions where we're not really getting snow or temperature very well. And this is very important for any western U.S. water work. So we are missing things in the U.S. and especially we're missing some of these smaller scale storms that tend to pop up now and again. So types of downscaling. So there's a simple downscaling, and all that is if I have a climate gauge right here, and I'm basically, if the node, the GCM node above me predicts a 2-degree increase, all I'm doing is adding a 2-degree increase to my particular climate gauge. That's pretty much it. That's as simple as it gets. And there's statistical downscaling, and that's what I'll be talking about mainly today. And what you assume is a stationary transfer function. So I showed you earlier a figure of the bias where the GCMs have a little bit of a wet bias. We assume that wet bias is also occurring for the future as well. If they're biasing for the historical runs, we assume that this bias is also happening for the future runs. So that's a stationary bias transfer function. You just assume that the bias is also happening. And then there's dynamic, and I also mentioned that before. This is the RCM downscaling. This works pretty well, and it's shown by the kind of the green, which roughly, actually, the cake thing in between the top. So that's basically a 10-kilometer scale. Better representation of terrain, captures local processes and feedback, very computationally expensive. And if you have bias in your GCMs, which are the out boundary conditions, then you're going to have bias in the RCMs as well. So you need to fix that bias. Anyways. So I'm going to talk about one method. This method was developed by Andy Wood and Ed Maurer, who was my postdoc advisor. So I do have, I am a bit familiar with this method. So the BCSD method, it's a bias correction spatial downscaling method. So basically, your GCM output looks at that top figure. We have a coarse scale resolution. So for each grid cell, you develop for the training period. So this is essentially like calibrating a hydrologic model. You have the first 30 years or 15 years. Most people do between 50 to 90 or 60 to 90, something like that. The more, the better. But basically, you develop cumulative distribution functions for precipitation and temperature for the GCM at each grid node, but also the observations at each grid node. So the observations have been aggregated up into the GCM scale. Okay, so the observations that I showed before with all of the red and blue, red and black dots, so those are the observations. But you can also get gridded data sets as shown below, but basically you aggregate the observations to the GCM scale. And you can see when you plot these CDFs on the right, you can see that the GCMs have a bias, and they're represented by the black line, while the observations are represented by the red line. So you need to correct for this bias, and for this method, you use quantile mapping. And this is to ensure that the monthly statistics of the GCMs match the monthly statistics of the observations. That's what you're trying to do here. And you apply the same quantile mapping to the entire projected period. So what is quantile mapping? So essentially, I have three columns. I have the observations, I have the model uncorrected, so this is GCM without the bias corrected, and on the right I have the GCM bias corrected. So what I need to do is calculate the quantiles, this median, quartiles, 95th, 99th percentile, all of these for the observed and the GCM historical runs. So if you look at the first column, that's the observations, and you look at the model uncorrected, you can see that there's bias, the dry bias, actually this is temperature, there's a cool bias in this model uncorrected. So what you do is you apply a linear transformation to each quantile of the GCM to adjust to adjust its range to match the quantile in the observed data. And that's what you've done on the right as well. So you can see that you've corrected the bias and all the way to the right column where the quantiles now match up in the GCM. So you applied this quantile mapping to the biased GCM data to have it match the observed data for the training period. And then you assume that this is happening in the future as well. So this same bias correction is also for the future data as well. So what this method actually looks like? Well, you have you use the bias corrected monthly GCM output. That is what we just did. You aggregate the observations to the GCM scale. That is also what we did before. So you're talking about panels number one and number two. And to do future climate changes, you need to calculate the precipitation and temperature factors between of the core scale of climatology. So this is shown in panel three, where for precipitation you're dividing 1 divided by 2. So your GCM divided by your observed. That'll tell you how much precipitation is changing for the future. Okay. And for temperature, you do the same thing, except you're just subtracting the two. Okay, so just subtracting the two. And this is panel three. So you need to interpolate these precipitation temperatures factors back to the original observed climate grid, which is shown in number four. And now you apply those precipitation and temperature factors back to the original observed climate. And hopefully at your end, you have a final product that is a downscale GCM data that is the same grid as the observed data shown in panel six. So you develop these basically change rates, and you apply these to the observed data. So there are other methods for downscaling, and I'm not going to go on to really any of these. But the BCCA, that's also by Ed Maurer, that is daily GCM data for anyone that needs daily data. The MACA data set at the bottom is interesting in the fact that it also has other climate variables that you may be interested in. So solar radiation, wind, and humidity, those are downscaled data as well. And these are all freely available. Just do a Google search for these. So you have all of these GCMs. You go to one of these websites and you see that there's 30 GCMs, 4 emission scenarios. So what do you actually need to do now? Well, basically just download, if you can, download them all. Because each one of them has a certain amount of skill. Each of them will predict something a little bit differently for the future. And using all of these GCMs, the ensemble mean, the median, and quartiles provide a better skill than just using one GCM at all. So watershed model, you input a GCM, you just keep doing it until you have a lot of time series. You make statistical estimates on those time series. Some GCMs, as I've talked about before, have a better track record of simulating climate in the historical past where they need a little bias correction. It's been found that basically weighting those more in your ensemble doesn't really do much. Okay, so again, it's best to just throw everything into the watershed model and just see what look at your time series. And one of the most important things is to have ensembles of runs with enough realizations to reduce the effects of natural internal climate variability. So what this means is, and you can look at the little spaghetti plot in the bottom, you can see they're all moving up, they're all scattered all over the place, but they're all going up. And that's the main important thing about this, is to limit all of these squiggles, but basically be able to attach a mean or a median to this data to where it all goes up. So where can you find this type of data? I don't know whether some of you may or may not be familiar with this, but here are some websites where you can go there and you can download all of this data so you can do in your own analyses. The one I'm most familiar with are the top two. That one is, I believe, housed by the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. It's a nice little website where you can draw a square around your region and it extracts all the GCMs around a particular region, downscale GCMs. And then the MACA data set, that has all of the other climate variables which may be of interest for crop modeling, vadose modeling, anything that needs more than just precipitation and temperature. And if you're happy with just not downloading but looking, you can just go to the Climate Wizard itself, and that's basically like a Google map of all of these projections, so you can just look. And then you can also pinpoint certain lat longs and see what the projections are for that lat long. All right, so you've downloaded it, now what to do? So this downloaded GCM data, downscaled data, is often in NetCDF format. And that stands for Network Common Data Form. It has an extension of a .nc. So if you download it, it's just one file, and it's .nc. So there are not a lot of files, it's just one file. And this is a multi-dimensional data set. So this is the latitude, longitude, time, and climate variable, but it can also have many climate variables, so it can be many multi-dimensional. So it's kind of hard to wrap your head around what that actually means. But luckily, there are programs that work with NetCDF. MATLAB, R, ArcGIS. I use MATLAB for all my NetCDF work, but MATLAB has a tool. You just throw it in there, and you can start analyzing it, just like it's a matrix. There are programs developed by NCAR, CDO, and NCO that are built specifically for NetCDF work. Okay, and those work quite well as well. So now that you have downloaded it, so now you can basically take a step back and look at your watershed model. And I'm just showing a Sierra Nevada watershed model that I built a few years ago. And I'm not really going to go over what the SWAT model is. Everyone has already done that. But this is the Sierra Nevada SWAT model, 379 sub-basins calibrated at 35 stream flow outlets. And this is forced with some of that gridded data that I talked about earlier from Maurer at the 12-kilometer resolution. And I've downloaded 6 GCMs from the one of the websites I talked about earlier for 2 emission scenarios. A2 represents a high emission scenario. B1 represents a very low emission scenario. Okay, so if you go to my website and you do use SWAT and you can go to one of these websites that I show, I've written a code that extracts, basically it rips apart the NetCDF data and puts it directly into SWAT file format. So basically you can download the NetCDF data, and if you have MATLAB or you have R, basically change the name of the file and it rips it up and it looks like a SWAT input file. So you can easily download all of these GCMs, run this code through it, and you'll have something that looks like that on the right, where that is your gridded downscaled data set. That's your gridded downscaled data set, and there are thousands and thousands of little dots there, but each dot has a particular input file associated with it. SWAT understands what that is, so it can run right through it and create your files. And then you can do all sorts of neat stuff once you have all of this GCM in SWAT format. You just run them on through your calibrated model, and you can make all sorts of cloud plots, median quartiles, all this type of average plots, and you can make some statistical analyses based on that. So quickly, the conclusions. GCMs are useful for climate projections. They are not very useful for anyone working at the watershed scale unless you downscale them and correct the bias that they have for your particular region. Again, they have bias compared to observed data due to their spatial resolution and parameterization. There are different types, flavors, only downscaling. I only went over one today, but they all seem to have skill. They all do something differently. Most of the GCM data is in a NetCDF format, which I had talked about, but there are codes available where you can rip this apart and put it into whatever kind of input format that you need to do it. And then you can use all of this GCM data to ensemble, GCM ensemble to bracket and plausible ranges of projections for basically anything that you need for it to do. And that's all I have, so thank you.
Thank you. About 4 minutes for questions.
Mr.
Sterling.
I'll just let you pick up, man.
I don't care.
I'm just wondering, are you working on obfuscating the same way, or have you worked on obfuscating? Since you discussed about the downscaling, so I just wonder.
I personally don't do the upscaling, no. You're talking about from climate up into, it's basically an interpolation backwards. If you're talking about using climate observations, you do have to upscale your climate observations to match the same resolution as your GCM. So there is a bit of an upscaling, but not, yeah.
So just to confirm, are you recommending that you apply, you're putting the actual RCM data into your model, or are you taking your original data and applying Delta
factors? The procedure is you have a watershed model that you've calibrated with observed data. And then after that, you input the GCM data directly. So all of this shown right here, this is actually, GCMs start in 1950 and they go to 2099. So I recommend just throwing the actual downscaled GCM data into it, not do the delta factors.
And do you recalibrate based on the GCM historical
time frame? You don't need to. Especially if I use the same gridded data set as was used for the training period.
So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any research on stationarity of quantile correction?
I have not done that. Ed Maurer, who is the one that developed this method, has. And some of the things he found that the bias correction can change a lot of a future, especially for extreme events in the future, especially at the daily scale. I personally haven't done that. Ed Maurer would be the one that would probably do all that. I'm more into using the data.
How long has it used a time period to develop bias
correction? As far as I'm concerned, the more the better. Basically, anywhere between 50 to 1980, 50 to 1990 would be a good time. You kind of don't want to get the signal when things start on the uptick, but 60 to 90 is what I see, 50 to 90 is what I see.
Any difference between the regions?
Between the regions?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are differences. That's why you do it for every single grid node. Every single basically grid node. I don't know where that, but you do the same bias correction for every single particular grid node. So it is computation expensive. You do need a supercomputer to do this bias correction. So you do the bias correction for every single grid node.